Here yet. There we go. This is Truth Quest with Melody, and this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And my guest tonight is a special guest, and we actually got him the very first thing here, and it's Michael Tesarian. And he's born in Northern Ireland. Michael Tesarian is an expert on occult histories of Ireland and America, and he's made the deepest researches into Atlantis, origins of evil, and into the Irish origins of civilization. He's the author of the acclaimed book Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation, and is the producer and presenter of Origins and Oracles, a DVD series which explores ancient mysteries and forbidden knowledge. Michael gives outstanding presentations on the following subjects: Western magical tradition, the Hermetic arts of divination, Atlantis and prehistoric ages, Ireland and the Druids, astrotheology, the origins of evil, secret societies, war on consciousness, subversive use of sacred symbolism, symbol literacy, and psychic vampirism. And while I'm at it, I need to say that support for Cahen and Truth Quest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. Is there anything you'd like to add to that? Well, some people's are really quite long, but I think that's relatively brief. But you're very prolific, and there's so many different avenues and interests that you have that it I didn't even know where to begin to start, other than to let you get started on what where you'd like to go, because obviously you have your
Well, Jim Keith was certainly a big inspiration for me, because, as I said, his books were so, you know, upfront and so incredible, full of information about something that's very, very important. And he basically was a student of mind control in all of its forms. He did talk about the radiotronic aspect of it, getting into the frequency, you know, the way that frequencies are used, both microwave and both other. He got into MK Ultra. He got into Project Monarch, and he really showed how mind control has been used. I had already been studying how whole nations had been systematically mind controlled, you see, over millennia, as a matter of fact, certainly hundreds of years.
Uh-huh.
And so I wanted to get more deeper into that, because, of course, what do we have today? We have so much interest right now on mind control.
Okay.
And we have so much interest on technology and where we're going with that.
Uh-huh.
It's a big, you know, worry. But what is happening a lot in the conspiracy movement, or the alternative research movement, and it's been going on for quite a while, but it's been going more since 9/11, is a lot of us versus them type of scenario, in the sense that a lot of writers and researchers still remain within the frame of blaming some sort of, you know, hidden elite or whatever, you know. And of course there is a hidden elite. It's important to know about them, and it's important to find out what they're doing. But my work tends to also bear in mind and stresses, it's not just a case of, you know, some evil overarching, you know, predatory force. It's also what we might be doing, what ordinary human beings are doing, to, number one, vote these people into power, to give away our own power to these people, and what it might be in the consciousness of human beings that makes them submit. And when you look into the whole question of submission, and when you look into the whole question of slavery, you're not talking about something recent. You're talking about something quite ancient. It goes back through the Middle Ages. It goes back to the birth of Christianity and beyond even that. So this question of mind control is not just a modern thing. So where the Jim Keith was, you know, focusing a lot on the individual and how individuals might be mind controlled when they unfortunately come under the the power or control of the military, you see, or these men in white. My work tended to take what Jim Keith was talking about and then really apply it across the board again to show that, you know, man can very much have his habitat manipulated and transformed, and he won't be able to see that. And what about societies? What about the sociological implications of this kind of mass control? So this is where we started with the DVD. And, you know, it took about a year to create. As I say, this DVD is program one. It's going to be a series we're going to do, getting deeper and deeper into this aspect. And again, trying to a little bit veer away from the idea that it's just some hidden them.
Uh-huh.
Because when you get into that, if you just sit around and sort of bash, you know, the Illuminati or the White Brotherhood or the Freemasons or whatever, the trouble with that, the flip side of that, is that that breeds paranoia. That breeds fear. That breeds a lot of fear-mongering, a lot of unnecessary finger-pointing, and basically a lot of paranoia. And if you've studied, you know, what's going on in the conspiracy movement today, you'll see that paranoia is rampant. It's heated up since 9/11. It also creates a lot of divisionalism. Anytime you're into an us and them situation, that tends to not be very holistic. It tends to put people into boxes. It tends to have, it divides people. And even though it's very legitimate to realize that there's a sort of a war on consciousness and there is a hand that is working day and night to keep people under control, how far can you go along that road, you see, of just keep pointing fingers? So it's time, I think, to also bear in mind how man himself, what it is in the psychology of ordinary human beings that makes them prey to this problem, because it's an age-old problem. And even if we don't talk about tyranny or control or submission on the social governmental level, we can even talk about it in relationships. I mean, when we start talking about how men and women submit, we don't even have to go much further than the place of work or the relationships that people are in. You know, this thing is really close to home. So it's something that one needs to look at, you know, how the parents treat their children, how we treat animals and nature, how women have been treated down through the generations. You know, this whole question of the master-slave is not simply reserved to, you know, the corridors of power. It's something that happens within religion, within relationships, within the place of work, as I said. It's everywhere. So it's a tremendous study, and it's very, very important that we start to sort of adjust our settings so that we start to look at also what it is within human beings that allows them to become slaves. Because, as we said in the DVD, somebody can sell you something rotten, but you don't have to buy it. So if we see that people are buying it, you know, we also want to address that question. And that's what the whole series is really about.
And what made you get started in this direction?
Well, as I said, it was reading the works of Jim Keith and others. I think what got started is probably growing up in Northern Ireland and seeing this particular kind of, you know, jackboot regimentation, this kind of cliqueism, as I said before. You know, we might call it sectarianism, and we see it. Look at it now. We've got the Jews against the Muslims, even though the patriarch, the founding father of what by their own words, Judaism is based on the patriarch Abraham and Jacob and Isaac and all of that. And is not Abraham also the patron of the Muslims? Don't the Muslims also say that their Quran and their teachings is based on the teachings of Abraham? So how can you have the same patriarchs? How can you acknowledge that the same fathers spawned and created your religions and yet be, you know, always murdering each other down the line? Is that something sane, you see?
No.
Where you look, organization.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, there's actually another DVD I want to talk about that we also released. It's the compact of my Irish Origin of Civilization book. Basically, as we released the Architects at Control, I also released a six-part DVD series to go with my own book. And in that DVD,
mm-hmm.
I made the point that when you use the word colonialization or colonization, the habit of most people think in militaristic terms. They think that those are terms that are, you know, you're talking about the spread of empire, the Roman Empire, whatever, and that's true. But in the modern age, we also have to look at the colonization of the human mind. We're talking about the controllers here, misunderstanding what they are as people. They know about the brain, they know about synapses, they know about the hormones, they know about our livers, they know about sexual needs and orientations, you see. They know all about the different instincts, and complexes that make up a human being. They know the intricacies of what thinking is. They know what emotion is. And so they have a lot of tools on their side. And so that's what basically got me into it, is just, you know, don't forget that half of my family is from India, so we've also dealt with an enormous colonization there. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a lot of doublespeak. We're talking about every empire today, whether it's the Belgians, the French, the Portuguese, you see the English, and even the Americans. Look at America now. America now is basically an aristocracy. It's a new empire. Their policies are imperialistic. So, you know, we have colonization and colonialization still going on today, as bad as it was at the time of Queen Victoria, as the time it was during the Romans, as it was during, you know, Alexander the Great, and all the way back through time. Nothing changes. And how I got started, you see, is I've always been interested in the mystical questions. My interest in politics is an occult interest. It stems from metaphysics. It stems from the whole metaphysical question of why is it that men and women don't change? They may have more perks. They may have more superficial pastimes and escapes. But is man psychologically different than he was back in the Middle Ages? When it comes to the, you know, father figure, and when it comes to the questions of submission and slave-master relationship, and when it comes to the, you know, attraction-repulsion dynamics, you know, very little has actually changed in a way. Man has remained very primitive psychologically. And to me, this, all these other fascinating things that we study in the conspiracy movement are brilliant, and I love it, and I've done a lot of work on those before, done writings and DVDs. But always underneath it, you see, is this whole question of man's psychology, because it's his psychological temperament and it's a psychological complexion that leaves him open to all kinds of submission. As I said, if it's in a really personal relationship, or if it goes further up the, you know, the scale to the governmental level. So, you know, I find that a lot of scholars in this field are not looking into this enough. And so, you know, this is something that I really wanted to get into and do, and make it also very topical for people, and try to get people to sort of, you know, take on board this particular, you know, philosophy. It's very interesting to me, and from the reports that we've got back and the feedback, you know, people really love it. So I'm really happy to see the positive feedback on the Architects of Control project that we did.
What do you expect to do in the next stages of this project?
Well, we're filming at the moment. We're actually starting to put together, you know, the second and third programs, and just get a little bit deeper into the same kind of thing. There's so many angles you can take, but what I really wanted to get into is something that we talked about. I'd actually talked about on a web stream that I did in Los Angeles, and this is been heavily watched by people, and a lot of people hit me back, you see, after seeing that. It's on Google, it's on YouTube, and people have been repeatedly emailing me and saying, could you do something more on that? Because, you know, you got into some interesting things, but, you know, we'd like more information on that. And one of the things that, there's so many things we could, you know, get into that we were going to get into, but one of them was this whole thing again of how the ego is constructed, how consciousness is constructed. And one of the most interesting things comes out of the work of Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud was the first man to basically show that there's an anatomy of consciousness, or an anatomy of thinking, meaning that, you know, just like we know we've got two arms and two legs and a head, you know, we know the physical anatomy of people. What about the anatomy of man's mind, consciousness? Is there anatomy of thinking? And so Freud went into this, and basically, to make it simple for people, he basically had a tripartite system. He divided consciousness into about three basic parts. One was the unconscious, of course, which he called id. In German, the word id is almost like our English word it. So he didn't even name the unconscious. The unconscious is basically unnameable. And in German, he just called it the it, you know, this mysterious place that where the lights are turned off, where we go when we sleep, you know, dream time, where the people like the aboriginals, you see, are talking about the dream time. And the big question is that the spiritual realm? Now, here's an interesting side point before I go on, and that is that in English, the American APA, and this involves also the English translators of Freud, always toned down drastically his spiritual connotations to his findings. In German, the words are deeply meaningful in a spiritual context. But when his books were translated, even the covers of his book, even the names and titles of the book, were drastically changed in order to make it more materialistic than Freud ever wanted it to be. They wanted to make it more Pavlovian. They wanted to make his teachings more behavioral. In other words, a certain propaganda was used in the mere translations of Freud. So basically what I'm saying is that when people read about Freud, or they pick up a dictionary, generally what we've heard about Freud, even taught from the schools, is actually not very accurate. he's made into this, you know, supreme atheist, or, you know, a person who had no sort of a metaphysical interest, and all of these kinds of things. And of course, this is absolutely not true. But getting back to our point, he did believe that the unconscious was a spiritual sort of realm. There was something there that, you know, might have been of a spiritual nature, something deep and something rich, as well as the idea that he also believed that the unconscious is a sort of a dumping ground for all of the stuff that we don't like about ourselves. You know, he came up with the word repression. And repression is simply the things about life, and much more importantly, the things about ourselves that we don't like, we repress into the unconscious. The second part of his tripartite breakdown of consciousness was, of course, the ego. He basically came up with that word, ego consciousness. This is the part where the lights are on. This is what gives us our awareness. This is what turns on when we wake up in the morning, and so forth. And then there was a third part, a very important third division, which is called the superego. And the superego is like the big daddy. It's the policeman within. It's the part of us that is our moral sensibility, what he also called the conscience, and what today is commonly called the conscience of a person. Because it's one thing having an ego, but we know there are many psychopaths in the world. So it's the superego, this part of the ego that developed out of the ego, that's like a sort of administrator, like a sort of a headmaster within consciousness. And this is the kind of inner, almost godlike voice that reprimands us when we do bad things. So in the LA talk that I did, I was saying that this superego is itself divided into two. So we have the three parts of Freud's, you know, schemata, which is the unconscious, the ego, and the superego. But the superego itself is divided into two drives. One is known as the prohibitive drive, and the other one is the permissive drive. And you find that the superego's first representatives or first programming is with the parents. So a child is what is known as polymorphously perverse. What that means is that a child has no morality when it's born. It has no concept at all about good and bad. You know, it's in a state of animism or autism, in which it's so in its own mind. A child is more driven by the unconscious. These things like the ego and the superego haven't developed strongly yet. So the parents are there to teach the child what is right and what is wrong. And of course, it goes without saying that the parents are the representative of the world. Right? The parents themselves have learned what is right and wrong from their parents and from going to work and from seeing, you know, the representatives of the law and learning the hard way, often, what is right and what is wrong. And their duty is then to teach these sort of virtues and morals to the child.
Well, Michael, let me first...
And the parents... Yeah.
Let me go ahead and just say this is Michael Tesarian, that is my special guest on Truth Quest with Melody, and my co-host, Katie O'Brien. I believe she's still there.
I am.
Okay. I think she's just highly caught up into your what you're speaking about. And you're speaking about, again, for the audience, Michael. Michael?
Well, we're talking about, you asked me where I was going with the program, and I was just trying to explain that it grew out of this talk that I did in LA, and that, you know, we've had a lot of feedback saying people wanted more explanations of this, because as we get into this role of the parents, we find something very, very interesting. I was speaking about the strict Freudian approach is that he believed that the parents teach the child what is right and what is wrong, and subconsciously it's divided, the man's consciousness is divided into what is permissive, right? When you're allowed to do things, which is good, then you get good rewards, and when you do bad things, you're prohibited. Well, the interesting thing about this is when you take this particular psychic scheme up or down, whatever way you want to look at it, to the political level, you find the same thing in operation there. For instance, to make it clear for people, look at the Republican versus the Democrat, you see, or let's say the conservative versus the socialist type of person, the liberal type of person. What you're actually seeing there is a playing out of what is going on within man's consciousness. In other words, the political sphere of operation is precisely based on this primal, unconscious, mental setup. And so, like I was saying earlier to you, mm-hmm. in the beginning, how can we break the tyranny, you see, unless we know its roots? And my philosophy is that the roots of all tyranny are within consciousness. And here I'm just giving you a perfect example of this, that when we see this so-called permissive, which would be the liberal, you know, I mean, people can split hairs over this, but just in general, we have the liberal attitude in the political milieu, and we have the more conservative, restrictive, punitive, you see, prohibitive side. And it's fascinating to see that these two wings in the political sphere are absolutely based upon how man's own consciousness works. And so that really basically is a huge giveaway as to what is really going on here. And that it's thinking itself, and it's man's matrix, you see, that brings into being all the different kinds of phenomena that we find in government. We know that, for instance, another little angle to this is the relationship that Western so-called civilized man has habitually had down through the centuries with so-called uncivilized tribes. Okay, let's take that. It's a well-known fact. History is replete in it. We've had endless shows on TV and PBS about how Western, you know, powers colonized Africa, how blacks were treated, how pygmies were treated, how the Indians were treated, you know, during the time of Queen Victoria, how the Vietnamese were treated by the French, the Belgians, I believe the Portuguese and the English. They were like so colonized, it's not even funny. But in everywhere that you find this kind of imperialistic drive, hasn't the black man or hasn't the dark man always been considered sort of like a primitive, a subspecies? And the white man, you know, from the West has also been considered sort of superior? Again, Freud and Jung would say, well, that is again based on the unconscious, based on the way that the mind is working, where everything that's in the light, everything that has standards, everything that appears to be modern and progressive is aligned with the frontal lobes, is aligned with the ego. And everything that is not, and which appears sort of, you know, free form and feminine and maybe primitive, right, is attached to people's unconscious. And so as we've moved down as human beings through the millennia, we have developed greater walls within ourselves between the conscious and the unconscious worlds. Modern man today is very cut off from his unconscious. That's the way society also, it's one of the downsides of living in civilization and society, that through the schooling and through the different forms of regimentation, you see, this right brain, free-flowing, imaginative, creative, spontaneous, drives these complexes, this kind of expression, is cut off. That has a worldly component. As I said, it's in the schism between, say, civilized and non-civilized people. But we don't even have to look globally for that. We don't even have to look, you know, north and south of the equator. These kinds of prejudices exist even within nations. We have all sorts of prejudices. I mean, my goodness, anybody who's gone to India knows fine rightly that the most racist people on the face of this earth live in India, to the point where they even have a caste system where certain people are considered untouchable. And believe me, untouchable is not the lowest class. I mean, in Hinduism, you've got even lower than that. So what could be more reprehensible, you see? And this again, no matter where you go, from what corner of the earth, no matter under what religion people are hiding, no matter under what sort of, you know, veneer of civilization people are hiding, we have these prejudices. They're in every single country. And this is what is causing the various divisions you see between people. Because it's again based on man not being integrated within. So nothing political is truly political. But nothing external is really external. It's all based on what we are inside ourselves.
Okay, and so you were saying then that has something to do with our conscious and our subconscious? Am I following you correctly?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, the more and more man gets alienated from his own unconscious, even whether some people believe the unconscious is the spiritual realm, others would, you know, say no, it's not, but it really doesn't matter. The point is that the creative wellspring from which we, you know, arise, from which consciousness itself arises, is the unconscious. And if you get too cut off from it, you end up being a stranger to yourself. And you can see that our whole Western civilization is based on having people live entirely on the surface of themselves. This is what we went into the LA talk, you see. I even had a diagram showing the realm of the persona, And you only have to look at the media to realize just how, you know, incredibly much there's an interest in having people just decorate their persona to the at the cost of all of their other, you know, aspects and selves. You know, we're not interested in people anymore, what they are inside deeper. People are just forced to live on in the ego and in the narcissistic drives, you see, and pulling further and further away from their own core, further and further away from their own unconscious.
So
when man does that, that becomes the way he lives in society, you know. So if you look at the design of cities, the design of skyscrapers, you look at the fluorescent lighting, you see, even within in many offices now, and this whole emphasis of the square and the cube, and this whole emphasis on regimentation in so many ways, whether it's at Starbucks, you know, I don't know if people have any observed any of this. Often they haven't observed any of this. They're not even remotely aware of just how regimented and formalized just the average living is, you see? And this whole penchant for franchises and the design of cities being based on the grid and all of these kinds of things, it's so ubiquitous we don't notice it. But unfortunately, the psychologists do notice it, and they know that it's not healthy, it's not right. And again, it's predicated upon human beings. And going back to what I said before, if man, history actually moves in interesting phases. Just like we talk about the prohibitive and the permissive, it turns out that in history, you also have waves. It's like a rhythm, a moving rhythm in which some ages are more permissive and some ages are more prohibitive. And it almost has a pattern to it. Like, for instance, back in the 1960s in America, right? That would be a permissive era in which suddenly the liberal modality is in and you're able to, you know, sort of go about and do what you want. And, you know, it's considered unfashionable to be, you know, a straight person up and down and going to work on all of these things. You know, and there's a huge conflict there because in the 1950s it was quite different. And if you watch a movie, for instance, like The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman, that whole movie explores this particular dynamic of the changeover between, you know, the prohibitive to the permissive life and the conflict and stress that often comes with that. It's about a young man, you see, who is trying to make this choice between doing what his parents want. You know, extremely famous movie about this, and has this incredibly iconoclastic ending in which he does a very rebellious thing, you see, and he finally breaks through the taboos and the sacred cows and keeps coming up against these authority figures. And then after the 60s, what happened again? We had another spate of conservatism, tremendous conservatism coming around in the 80s, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, you know, it'll be followed with a period of the punk rock era came in, and then it's a bit more liberalness, you see, and a little bit more free form again, a little bit more what they call Dionysian. And then again, that's followed up by another Apollonian period, which was the time of the computer nerds. And then after that, you get again, you know, some more permissiveness with the rap sort of music and the heavy metal and the rock and roll coming back in. And then again, with the Bush administrations, you see tremendous crackdown again and the rise of fundamental Christianity and stuff like this. So when a psychologist looks at history or sociology, and when you look even closer at the movement of government, you start to see this particular psychological scheme playing itself out in the world. And it's just incredible to see this. So that's basically, you know, the long and short of what we're doing. We're trying to create a lot of examples in this series so that people start looking into this and start to get savvy at this greater movement and not just get caught into the stereotypical action and lose track of this incredible movement in history, which, as I said, is again, you know, articulated to man's thinking, his consciousness. Whatever is in his mind finds its way out onto the world in this incredibly fascinating way.
Well, based on this particular progression and repetition of what's going through, if we've just gone through a crackdown with the whole Bush administration, what should be coming up?
Well, you see, what's happening now is that we may be at a very important juncture in which a major change takes place. Because obviously, from what I've said, we could be positively heading towards a period of much greater freedom. There's talk of the age of Aquarius, for instance, you see? So on paper, mankind could be heading for the most free freedom he's ever had before. And I mean that also not just physically, but spiritually. There is a chance that man's consciousness is at the stage now where, you know, we have so much information now about permaculture, alternative living, you know, survival, free energy. We've got all the tools and all the knowledge at our hands, which wasn't there before. So my interest in these things is that, look, Big Brother doesn't just sit there waiting to be overthrown. As I've said, these people, these architects of control, have tremendous knowledge of these things. They know both astrologically where we're going, and they also have they have fingers on the pulse of man's psyche. So they're obviously not interested in people waking up. And from what I've said already, you can tell that that awakening could be a really marvelous thing. It would mean throwing off the shackles of all forms of religious and political control. Man has been, whether he likes it or not, moving towards this, because it's natural to move towards this. Nature wants the human being to move towards this. There's a spirit within people that wants freedom, as buried as it is. In all my work, what I try to show people is that you already would have freedom. You already would have a paradisical lifestyle. It's just that there's many weights and impediments on top, and they've been put there on purpose to keep you down. And what we're seeing now then, you see, is a great sort of almost critical mass in which the forces of Big Brother are really threatened by what might be coming. They've read it in the stars, so to speak. And so they're pulling out all the stops to prevent that from taking place. And this kind of movement of theirs has many, many tentacles. It's about dividing and ruling more, which you've seen, haven't you, since the Bushes came in? Not that they were the first, but hasn't there been so much more emphasis on schism and dividing?
Right.
And causing conflict throughout the world, you see? Yes, there's movements of acquisition. There's movements to create conflict. This is one of the areas. There is a more of a control of the media than there has ever been before. So much so that, I mean, even a person with a single brain cell can see that it's just consensus all the way. You see? They have surveillance.
Isn't it kind of a dualistic thing that they're doing? Because you're saying that at the same time that we have all this war and this division, but at the same time, all you're hearing is them talking about a one world order. Does that make sense?
That's right. And well, the one world order has not just been spoken of recently. This is something that's been, you know, age old. It's really age old. I mean, that's why they put it in Latin on the dollar bill. There's a reason why it's not in English, it's in Latin, because the New World Order is something that goes through, you know, back to the Roman Empire. All oligarchs, all royal houses, all these globalists have always tried to bring this. Adolf Hitler tried it. His second book was even called The World Order, you see. So this has been on the mind of all psychopaths. Because, as I was saying originally, my biggest concern is not that technology is bad. It's that technology in the wrong hands. Technology in the hands of the psychopath is what we need to work, you know, figure out. And so the DVD series is absolutely, when it's finished, it will be literally an encyclopedia of the psychopath. So that no one on this planet can ever look to these people again and imagine that they're sane. Or give their allegiance, you see? Because we've defined in the architects and control, we're defining what the psychopath is. We see that technology has the potential of doing great evil in the world, but also great good. And we're not saying that government is all bad. Government originally was a thing for the people, but state control is bad. And also, religion or politics or technology in the hands of maniacs or psychopaths or megalomaniacs, you see, is obviously a recipe for disaster. And remember that these architects of control don't like freedom. They are toxic people inside. They don't have a harmonious psychology. They have a pathology. They're infected by many, many, you know, mental disorders.
Well, in the way that they conduct their business and whatever with the corporation as its as the paradigm, that's a psychopathic entity in its own right, is it not?
Absolutely right. And this is what Joel Bakan wrote in his book, The Corporation, and also he showed in his DVD, The Corporation. You see, even the word corp means death. In Latin, it means a dead body, like a corpus. So there's something dead, there's something necrotic, there's something lifeless, there's something zombie-ite about even behind the idea of corporation, a body. It's a body of something. But is it a live body? Is it something that acts upon rational standards? Of course not. These things are exploitatory. These things are not sustainable. And just like any state edifice, their whole modus operandi is basically confiscation and extortion. It's the same with the federal system in America, and it's the same with the banks in England, and so all over the world. It's the same with the World Bank, the IMF, you name it. So this is what comes out of a pathology. But of course, when somebody like Joel Buchanan is saying that a corporation is psychopathic, of course what he really means is that it's the people who have created and run those corporations are psychopathic. That's what he really means. And so it's people again. We seem to, it's a strange quirk of civilization, that all the worst psychopaths that could possibly exist, we tend to promote into the positions of the greatest power. The Winston Churchills, Joseph Stalins, the Vladimir Lenins, the George Bushes or whoever it might be. The list is endless. It's absolutely endless. Going back to Charlemagne. And the Duke of Wellington, whoever all the maniacs, Oliver Cromwell, and so many other psychopaths. These are the people who somehow, rise to the top, and they are able to then steer the ship of state. And this is the tragedy, you see, that the great voices and the great teachers, they're not promoted, they're actually suppressed, if anything. And over time, the psychopaths who have the control, they are not happy in a healthy, organic, living, creative, flowing, spontaneous type of setup. That's very threatening to them. So that's where the regimentation is coming from. That's where the mass control is coming from. And that's also why they wish to infect the whole world with their own particular kind of virus. And my message then is almost like that of a homeopathic doctor, is what can we do to not only diagnose this problem, but then what can we do to, homeopathically remedy it? And, of course, the answer is to strengthen your own immune system. Not physical immune system, but in this case, psychic immunity. And you can't do that without addressing the subject of psychology. And that is why I'm one of the first people to blend the conspiratorial, phenomena, the studies that we have in conspiracy, and sort of bring consciousness back in instead of leaving it at the door. It's very, very important because this pathology does exist in these people. They are not lovers of freedom. They are not lovers of liberty. They deal in genocide. They have dealt in genocide. What we're talking about here is absolutely documented fact. These are not healthy people. And especially another most important point is that these individuals, though they may be in a nation or they may be ruling a certain country, never let us make the mistake that they actually belong to that country or care at all about the people in that country. This goes for the royal families. It's often said, the Queen of England or the Duke of Belgium or something like that, or the Kaiser of Germany or what have you. You know what I mean? But this is actually another symptom of mind control. None of these royal families give a damn about the countries in which they come. The only reason why they're in those countries is to send the poor people of those countries off to die in wars for their benefit. The royalists are globalists. They've always been globalists. They're one. That's why they talk about, as you said, the one world order, because one world order is what they're all about. They are on the planet Earth for the subjugation of all mankind. It doesn't matter if it's Emperor Hirohito over here or some, other potentate over there. As far as they're concerned, that is purely, for the propaganda purposes to keep people waving flags and thinking that, these people really. This is why the Windsor family, for instance, changed their name. The name of Windsor was, created, I think, in the early 1920s. Their names are actually all, Germanic and Dutch, not Dutch, but German. Greece, Prince Philip is originally from Denmark and from Greece. The Queen's family comes from the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha and the Guelph families. The Queen Mother, who died, right? This present queen's mother was called Bowes Lyon, which is an old Scottish line that has its history in Germany also. You see? So these individuals are one global network. It's only for convenience that they try to give the impression that they're actually, kindred to the lands in which they have gained parasitical domination, Nothing could be further from the truth. And this is why today...
Go ahead.
Well, just my final point was that's why today you will find that it's the same. Did you know it's the same Habsburgian monarchs, the descendants of the Habsburgs, the descendants of the House of Hesse, the descendants of Oldenburg, you see, like Prince Charles, It's all these same descendants that today are behind the one world order economic community set up in Europe. They're behind all the MEPs. They say they don't have power, they just have influence. But believe me, influence is power. You know, and if you check out how many great corporations and companies have these royal figures as advisors and people who sit on the board, you'd be absolutely amazed. They not only have power over the military, they have power over lots and lots of business interests and charities and all sorts of different orgs and think tanks. So nothing has changed. It's just they, you know, wear suits now instead of royal robes, and they have a lot of front men, you know, to work their agenda while they stay sort of in the background. You know, but really, ultimately, nothing has changed, and the study of even the symbolism will show you that nothing has changed at all here.
So they just kind of modernize the symbology and just carry it on through?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely, that's exactly what they do. What they do is they create fictitious. There's basically two things they've done. One is that they have, for many years, disseminated the idea that there is no aristocracy. This is commonly held belief. That the aristocracy has completely faded away, you know, they have no more power and influence, you know, it's all finished, it's all over and done with. You know, you have your little royal family, Pallava, in England, you know, but these guys really have no power at all. That's the first big lie. And number two, they then work through a bunch of charities and a bunch of different kinds of orgs, sort of think tank-like orgs, to give you the impression that it's just good fun to come and, you know, sip coffee and talk about world events. As I said, they always make you believe they have certain influence, but no actual power. Anyone who knows anything about symbolism knows that that is the biggest crock of stuff you've ever heard before. You only have to study that. Let's give an example here. In England, the parliamentary system, right, is set up between two houses, the House of Commons and the House of Lords. The House of Lords, obviously by its name, is the landed gentry. These are people who are connected to the royal family, or they've been given privilege by the royal family. They're the lords. Then on the other side, you've got the House of Commons. And obviously its name indicates that this is just the common folk. It's people like you and I who, you know, might want to run for office, and get a few votes, you know, come down to the House of Commons and, you know, see what we can do politically and all the rest of it. However, the House of Commons never opens, you know, when they have the ceremony of opening during the year. It's a very precise ceremony in which the Queen's mace, this is a large scepter, and you can go on Wikipedia or you can go on and just go on to Google and type in and see, get a picture, you know, of House of Commons, and you will see that in front of the speaker, on a table right there between the two parties, sits the Queen's mace. Now, of course, they'll always tell you, oh, well, you know, Britain is a monarchy, so that's why we have the symbol there. But that is not the reason why it is there, because the opening of the House of Commons still uses the royal symbolism to show you exactly who's in control. It's the same with Canada. It's the same with many of these colonies. You know, it happened with the Falklands, in which they were only too happy to go and bomb Argentina, and even Prince Philip and all of these characters, Prince Andrew, went out there to play their part, you see. One has to fundamentally understand, and I come out of Ireland, for goodness sake. I'm not a Republican, I don't support the Republican cause, but at the same time, I'm no fan of the British government and you know, the kind of colonialism that they did in Ireland. So, you know, there's living evidence of this. In totally our own time, we've been able to see this. So there's a tremendous propaganda campaign to give you the impression that these people have no power, but they have tremendous power, and they have a tremendous power in America. Because Kissinger and Eagleburger and Weinberger, you see, and these different Brzezinskis and all of these people, and even Joe Kennedy and JFK and so many other people, major corporation leaders like Edgar Bronfman of Seagram's, you see, and the United Fruit Company, and the list goes on and on and on of the different corporation heads, and not more sinisterly, many presidents and top government officials have all publicly stated that they support Britain, that they are in love with Britain, that they're Anglophiles, and many of them even have rank in Britain. For instance, General Schwarzkopf, Colin Powell, you see, and many other people have been knighted by the Queen. Now, this is absolutely outrageous that any American who's true to America and true to the founding fathers' principles of the freedom and in Article 8 of the Constitution, it says no monarchs, no oligarchs can rule in this land. We're free and independent. Wars of independence were fought against the European monarchs and the British monarchs. And for any free American, you see, to get on their knees now and go and receive these very high awards, and you have Mayor Giuliani has got one, George Bush has got one, Bill Clinton received the Charlemagne Medal of Honor,
which
a European,
Bush?
You see, award. It's absolutely reprehensible that anybody would be doing this to the old enemies of America. And this is what people need to understand, is how this whole game works and who is really running the shop in. And even it's no different than this Obama. He himself is now related by blood, you know, to the same British aristocracy. They're all part of one family line.
And they track it all.
And where is Obama related to the royal family? Or to the aristocracy?
I can't remember right now, but we if people go to my forum, we have the information. People just need to go to my forum, and I have a YouTube link that goes into how he's who he's related to and how he's also related to these same people. Even I think he and Dick Cheney are related. You see, so
yeah,
all
are.
These people have relations. I've often said in my work, you see, that what we're dealing with here is people who are either biologically or ideologically related to these old, you know, the old world order, the old world system. And this old world order and the old world order controllers, all they're trying to do is create a new world order for themselves, not for us. What they've got planned for us. There's nothing orderly at all.
Well, they actually,
in a true sense of the word,
they act like they reinvent themselves, and all they do is just change their name and just kind of it's kind of like shuffling a deck of cards and just start all over with the same people, but they just kind of I don't know what the word I want here is, but they still put themselves at the top of the pyramid. And that they're the ones that still get all the money, but they just rearrange everything, and the middle class and the lower class probably changes a little bit, maybe. Does that sound at all what you understand?
No, I think it's like I said in the beginning, I think that there are changes, but those changes are basically superficial.
Those changes
is just moving the furniture around on the Titanic.
Right, that's what
ultimately,
I meant.
Ultimately, course that the ship is taking and the metal and the engines that are moving the ship remain exactly the same. And remember, we were talking earlier about pathology. It actually turns out to be another symptom of pathology that hierarchy even exists. Because we know, don't we? We've studied that there's two realities, the hierarchical, which is the pyramid you spoke of. And then there's the holarchy, which since the 1970s, scientists have started to understand. But, of course, the mystics knew about for millennia that how nature really works is exactly the same way as the human mind works. It's how the cell works. It's how the DNA works, is by a holarchic setup. Now, how then do you have these two? We've been talking a lot about these, you know, polar opposites. Well, this is another polar opposite that I've explored a lot in my work, the holarchy versus the hierarchy. And I really believe that the people who are best served by hierarchy, the ones who think it's great to be in this, as you say, top-to-bottom hierarchy, are the people who have the psychic disease. Because, you see, hierarchy doesn't exist in nature. But those who are, their thinking and their seeing is demented, see hierarchy where there's really holarchy. Now this is very involved, and another way to express it is the difference between magic and sorcery. The sorcerer always sees hierarchy. Somebody at the top, you know, controlling, and some person who needs to be controlled at the bottom. This is basically what hierarchy is. The spiritually awakened person, he looks at exactly the same phenomena, but he sees holarchy in operation. So it's almost like, and we went into this in the Architects of Control DVD, Henrik created an animation which shows Svengali, you know, like hypnotizing somebody, and sort of his eyes are like, you know, mesmerizing somebody. And this is what is unfortunately happening. The mesmerized person who's just gone along to get along, whose thinking is completely cut off from the unconscious, who has no spiritual component at all, whose entire thinking has been conditioned and mind controlled, will look at the universe, will look at nature, will look at the food chain, will look at the man's world, will look at, you know, social structures, and he will see hierarchy when it even doesn't exist. And there's no breaking that spell for the person who wants to, you know, see what isn't there. It's a delusion, and it's very difficult to wake somebody up from that. The already awakened person sees the same, you know, rose, but understands that it's so much more than that. It's so much more than that. He sees the fractal. He sees the sacred geometry in it. He sees the holarchic approach in it. His thinking is not damaged. Now, Alfred Lord Tennyson wrote a poem, and I think that it's The Two Voices. I'm not totally sure, but I think it's the poem The Two Voices, in which he says that man's perception, all he can do is see a straight stick bent in a pool. You know, when you put a stick into a pool of water, it appears to be bent.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he said that this is where our perception is. We have warped perception. He addressed this in other poems too, but in The Two Voices, I think it is, he says that man's sensual perceptions, you see, is warped. And sometimes we don't see the real at all. So what we're seeing now is a campaign to continually drip feed and mind control a zombie so that they lose their senses and do not see reality for what it is. This has been going on a long time. If you stop giving the Datura to the zombie, within 24 hours, he becomes normal. So if people say to me, oh, Michael, you're so pessimistic, I go, I don't know where you're getting this idea. Because there's not a word I've ever said that has to do with pessimism or is anything like that. Because I'm trying to say to people, look, if this injection of Datura was never given, man would actually very quickly recover his reason and his sanity. But he can't do that while he's being, on a daily basis, through the media and through the schools and through the religions of the world, being perpetually drugged, you see, constantly administrated, drip, 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 the same thing over and over and over and over again. So we don't have to add reason. You can't install it like buying something from a computer store and then install reason into your mind. It's already there, but it's buried under all the garbage. All that the spiritual teacher can do, all that any teacher can do, is address the fact that this garbage needs to be removed, you know, and how that can be done. And the rest is up to everyone. The rest is up to the people to work at it. You see.
Well, let me go ahead and give a station ID here before we get further into our conversation here. And you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody, and my co-host is Katie. And our guest this evening is Michael Tesarian. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHIN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And this is... again, KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, community-supported radio, and we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any of the past programs of Truth Quest, they're available on www.givebesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And... let me go one other thing here. And then support for KHIN and Truth Quest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. Now, Michael, when you're doing this series, I mean, I also got caught up in, do you see a lot, you don't see any difference between man now and you go way back into the beginning of civilization. So you're not seeing a whole lot of difference here. Is that what you were stating earlier?
Absolutely. I mean, it depends, of course, how far you go back. Mm-hmm. I do believe that there was pre-Diluvian cultures. I do believe there was, megalithic cultures. And I do believe that those people didn't have war. I think that the people who built the beautiful megaliths throughout the world, who were tremendously in touch with the cosmos, who lived more sort of on a matriarchal, shall we say, setup. Let's just say that they at least understood that there was, you know, the earth was a living thing. and so forth. We look at Egypt. We look at several cultures, and we see that there was less violence. And if there was violence, it was mostly defensive. So we do have that. We do see that. My work often, you know, has to do with the Druids. And it becomes quite obvious that everything that we were told about the Druids and their sort of bloodthirstiness is a complete and utter tissue of lies. This has been now exposed by many Celtic scholars. And this, of course, means that the Druids, quite the contrary, were extremely peaceful, were highly, mystical. They themselves tried to base their whole culture on the holarchic idea. And if they employed any kind of hierarchical setup, it was with a very small H, and it was only done for purification purposes, like a sort of shamanic type of schooling, in order to just simply, you know, assist in the purification process. Like, for instance, you would want to purify a particular chemical by setting up a large, you know, chemical experiment. There's nothing particularly hierarchical about that. But, you know, and don't forget that I'm not ruling out that hierarchical schemes, I'm not ruling them out. They have their purpose.
Mm-hmm.
We know that that reality does exist to a certain degree. But to become completely hierarchical in our thinking and in our understanding of the world order, especially when it comes to the universe and larger bodies, this is pathology. And as I said, it's a warped consciousness that sees it that way. Because the earth is, you know, round for a reason. The cosmos looks like a globe to us for a reason. Everything shouts holarchy and interrelationship. But unfortunately, as I said, you know, that warped mind doesn't see this beautiful yin and yang at all. It doesn't see the interplay. It doesn't conceive of this at all. It sees only physics. It doesn't see the alchemy. It's skewed. Our perceptions are skewed. And this is known even today when psychologists are studying individuals who are, you know, have dementia or are warped. Their vision of the world is very warped. And so unfortunately there's many kinds of this kind of dementia. And as society becomes more and more sterile, more and more regimented, more and more narcissistic, more and more cosmetic oriented, well, the trouble is that we get further and further and further away from that, you know, spiritual level, that God voice within ourselves. And then the man who becomes that alienated, Big Brother co-opts that by introducing the world religions. Knowing that man is raped spiritually, what do? They hand these fanatical and fundamentalistic religions, and we buy into it for the very reasons I said in the beginning. Knowing that we ourselves are living inauthentically, knowing that we ourselves are not doing our own spiritual homework, we go and buy into all of this evangelism and fundamentalism. So when you see what the Jews are doing, and when you see what the Muslims are doing, and when you see what the Christian right are doing, and when you see all these different fanatical movements in the world, again, remember what I've said, that this is again based on man's thinking. His need to cleave to these secure, what appears to be cliquish and secure and divided, you know, fragments, is based on the fact that he is deeply alienated within his own consciousness. And so what I see in the future coming is more of that. However, the controllers are very smart. They don't let you know that. So that's why they keep using terms. These are what's called talismanic words, like globalism.
Okay, I've got Michael Tesarian back, but we may have lost our co-host here for a second. There's still a little bit of few things that for me to learn about Skype to get things working correctly. But Michael, do you want to go ahead and you think you can kind of pick up the thread where we got lost here and you got cut off?
Gee, I can't remember what we were talking about just before the break, actually.
Well, we were kind of getting back into the little bit of the history of man with the control. And actually, what I would like to have done is go ahead and ask you some about, I mean, because you really do delve into some of the ancient history of man, and I find that really quite fascinating. And does it really tie in with your Architects of Control?
Yeah, it does, because the two go together so strongly, it's not even funny. We know, for instance, that a lot of extremely underinformed people keep on talking about that the Illuminati and these different world controllers are too much into paganism and all of this kind of thing. This is sort of, you know, when underinformed people come across this, or when they're listening to underinformed people, they get this impression that what is evil about these various Freemasons and Rosicrucians and Templars is because they're, you know, into paganism, and that's it, meaning they're not Christian. And this is about as far as people could go, you know. I mean, you could see a person who spends 15 years, and that they don't budge past that point. And yet, and that's not true at all. What is happening is that the people who are these secret societies today, who are the members of the secret societies today, they have a warped version of what might be called pagan beliefs. For instance, specifically solar cultism. Or let's be specific when we talk about the Druids. The teachings of the Druids it can be found. A warped version can be found in Freemasonry, you see, and Templarism and all of these things. Christianity is itself a warped branch of earlier teachings. Judaism is. So when people from Judaism and Christianity are pointing fingers at these various secret societies and claiming that these are people who are too much involved in paganism, you know, it makes you want to like almost cry if it wasn't so funny, you know, and so pathetic that this is what's going on. And this again comes out of the fact that there's huge gaps in their knowledge. They don't really know anything about how this whole thing works. So you're right. And the flip side of that is this, that you couldn't have any tyranny in the world. You could have absolutely no type of colonialization or colonization if the true shaman of the world, and I don't care if they're to be found in New Zealand or, you know, South America or Australia or India or Pakistan, you see, in ancient days, or they're South American or they're North American, the Arya are to be found everywhere, because the Arya is nothing to do with race at all. Aryan is nothing to do with race. Aryan is to do with spiritual caste. And men of great spirit can be found in all cultures, and they're of all colors and creeds. So if that kind of brotherhood, people who studied the stars, who studied the mystery of holarchy, whose thinking and whose mind and whose emotions was so clear and so centered, even their body, you know, the chi, they understood the mysteries of chi, they understood what yoga is really meant to be about, they understood about the sanctity of the individual and all of these kinds of things, they communicated with the animals, they were totally aware of the changes in the seasons, they work with the earth energies, you see, all of this kind of thing that is completely meaningless today. You know, these type of shaman, the Arya, the elders of old, had they lived, had they survived, well, you could just simply... Those roots of tyranny, those weeds of tyranny, could simply never have seen the light of day. So if you track back and you find that these tyrannies are rising at a particular time of the world, whenever you want to say it begins, the very fact that it exists in the world is over the destruction of the previous. So when we see records of the destruction of, you know, pre-Diluvian civilizations and down through even historical era, we see so many massacres and so many destructions and acts of genocide. There's a reason for that. It's happened in Ireland. It's happened in India. You see, the sorcerers cannot live if the magicians existed. It's just simply like a seesaw. It's absolutely black and white. So all these pernicious agents of tyranny, you see, and these disciples of power, these disciples of sorcery, all of their existence, every part of their existence, is predicated upon the destruction of their nemesis. This is what we're dealing with, because those two churches simply could not live in each other's shadow. It's not possible. The pure perfume, you see, of the real thing, of the real temples of light, would be enough to, you know, asphyxiate the evil ones. You know, this is what Professor Tolkien brought out in his Lord of the Rings, and so many other authors and filmmakers have even, you know, brought this out. So this is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with literally, you know, a sort of a scale. You know, one goes up and the other goes down. This is how it is. And so we have this propaganda, this poison, this tyranny in our world today, because it's built on the ashes of the destruction of what was in the past. Now, Truth can never be destroyed forever, you see. I just simply can't. So there has to be a constant injection, a constant drip feeding of the lie over the millennia in order to keep man drugged. Without that constant influx, you see, and constant infusion of poison, man would quickly recover his senses. That's what I believe. And then at that point, he may, you know, start to get with what's real again. And some, you know, truth would come back into the world. So all that we can do now is just diagnose that there is this pestilence. Hopefully people will wake up to it. And then the right kind of detergent can be applied, you see. This is, we're at the best time for that. Because our forefathers didn't have the tools. They didn't have the right way to combat this universal evil. You know, they didn't have the right perspective. There's all sorts of reasons why our forefathers, you know, just didn't have the power or the knowledge. And of course, it has a lot to do with literacy. We simply weren't literate. We weren't allowed to, you know, read. And we weren't allowed to develop ourselves and so on. It's taken a long, long, long time. And we are now at a tremendous point in history in which there could indeed be the movement towards, you know, a perfect organic society. But the agents of tyranny, you know, the agents of these architects of control, they don't want that. And so they're working overtime now to make sure that man is again fragmented and divided and controlled. Part of, we talked about how that is to do with creating lots of divisions between people of different religions. One of the other ways of doing that is to constantly be shaking up the economic stabilities. And aren't we seeing that? Mm-hmm. Every 5 minutes there's some trauma or some ripple going on within the economic world, because again that hits you on the limbic realm. It's like controlling food, controlling water, controlling food substances, you see. This goes on a psychological level to where man is in his security. And by constantly also pulling the rug economically, just like they did back in 1929, and just like they've done in many civilizations, they did it in Indonesia not too long ago, you see. Many cultures have fallen because of this. Many other cultures are kept under a form of slavery in this way by the World Bank and the IMF and various other orgs, you see, that conspire to keep civilizations under materially, because then those people can't grow, they can't educate their children, they can't even feed their children. And this is yet another form of dictatorship. So, again, when you want to control people, you often do this to not only traumatize them, but to make sure that they can't really progress.
Well, they
so
keep
again,
them
this
under,
is just, so they're just keeping another them under, tentacle of the power.
Yeah, so they're keeping them under constant stress. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
And as far
stress is a huge part of this.
Mm-hmm.
Stress is a huge part of it.
Right. And so what do you propose that we, you know, I mean, I'd like to understand how, when you stated earlier that you were kind of optimistic about us being able to rise above what has, you know, kind of kept us in this tyrannical oppression. What is it that you're looking at?
Well, for instance, that we're even talking about this on a radio show, and that goodness knows how many thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands of people, will be listening to it. You know, I did that little LA talk, and that turned out to be one of the most watched and most shared, you know, things on Google at one point. I think it's still like the fifth or sixth
you
most watched.
You have a tremendous amount of, when you get onto that YouTube and that sort, you have a tremendous amount of sites there that people can go listen.
That's right, and some of them are watched a little bit, and other ones grab people's attention massively. Within 3 months of doing that show, 800,000 hits.
Wow,
you know, that's a lot. That's a hell of a lot, you know. And by the time 6 months was over, it was you know, much more than that. And this is wonderful, you know. You know how many people were sitting in the hall? It was about 100 people there that day.
Huh.
And I'd done the same talk the day before at Huntington Beach, and there was about 60 to 80 people there that day. So even if you take both days that I did that little talk, you're talking only, you know, okay, let's even give it a maximum. Let's say the few people who wanted to come up maybe couldn't make it, the 200 people.
So
okay, look at the difference between 200 people who may have caught me live there, or not just me, but any speaker, you know. Richard Hoagland even will get maybe 500, you know, 600 people on a good day. He always draws a big crowd. Same with David Icke. Okay, big deal. What even if you say it's 1,000 people? Within, Within 25 days of putting one of the YouTubes up, it was 7,000 people had you know, clicked in to watch it.
Amazing.
You know, so this is why I'm optimistic. I'm also optimistic because, of course, I know that evil cannot win because nature abhors a vacuum. But when you take it over to the metaphysical dimension, nature abhors evil. There is nothing broken, there is nothing dead, and there is nothing, false in the creation. That only exists in one place, and that is the heart and mind of human beings. And my work has gone in, you know, to the origins of evil and all of that, to show how this warping came about, how this particular warping came about. But that is a tiny glitch. It's like a little, you know, eddy in the great ocean of harmony that exists in the world. You know, Professor Tolkien spoke of it as being disharmony. He really meant it in that way. He said that there's in the great symphony of God, and all the angels were in perfect, you know, harmony. They had a symphony of harmony. And in that harmony came the disharmony, you see, of the fallen one whose pride and ego and dementia, you know, came about. And it's a very good metaphor. It's absolutely a brilliant metaphor. But the universe, the natural order, does not basically, accept this kind of imbalance at all. The Egyptians understood this, and all people who studied the universe properly understand that. The farmer understands it, you know. The horticulturist understands it. The homeopath understands it. The martial artist understands it. They understand that doesn't mean that there's not negative things happening in the world. That does not mean that there's not various levels of imperfection. But those imperfections are in the eye of the beholder. And many of those imperfections are there to teach you a higher way of being. They're not negatives. They're something that is actually there for to create a higher form of existence. They're for us to negotiate. Just like the grain of sand inside the oyster, it compels the oyster to make a pearl. This is the holarchic way of thinking. This is how the martial arts understood it. Now, two people can be doing martial arts. One who's got a hierarchical thinking, and all he wants to do is beat other people up. His idea is to become, you know, like a sort of an SAS guy, going, yeah, I'm really good at martial arts because I want to go around and kill people. I want to dominate other people. The holarchic kind of person is entirely doing exactly the same kind of martial arts, but his entire understanding of it is completely different. He's working with nature. He's working in defense because he understands that there are things that can come to attack his sovereignty. Things that are demented, warped, vampiristic, evil. And he's protecting himself. He's also learning about the flow of his own energy. He's also learning about the energy of the evil that may come to, you know, compromise his sanctity. So look what we have here. We have the perfect diagnostician. We have a philosophy that says we are here to learn about what it is that is antithetical. We're in relationship with that thing. It's like I was talking earlier about, that's what my work is to do, is to start showing people now how they have a relationship with the things that happen in the world. It's not just a matter of us and them at all. Or some evil archy out there working autonomously, you see, in this way. We have deranged aspects of our own consciousness. We have dark emotions we don't want to look at. We're living in a culture, just before we got cut off there, I was going to say, that the person who is living totally on the surface of themselves, who is not connected to their healthy drives, who is very full of stress, like you said, anxious all the time, where do you think they run? They run straight to the man in white coat, to the pharmaceutical, to say, hey, give me the happy drug, doc, I feel bad, and I haven't the faintest idea how to deal with any of this, and I want you to, you know, anesthetize it, because I'm stressed, I got to go to work, I got to raise a family, you know, I don't want to be thinking, I don't know what's happening to me here. And now we have a Leviathan that you don't have to go to it, it's coming to you, telling you, yes, take this pill, take this. And, you know, this is where we're heading. It's very, very pernicious.
Right, and I often get asked, you know, how can I keep looking at some of the negatory things that are going on in our world? But it's like if you're going to get rid of the cancer, you got to get in there and get it all, and you got to understand
right.
it
That's
and
right.
get it out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the way of the shaman. They said that Horus had one black eye, dark eye, and one eye that was of light. The yin and the yang, the nagual and the tonal, you know, the prolific and the devouring. There's no way out of it at all. You have to see reality as it is, not a person's idea of reality. And what we're dealing with now is people's ideas of reality, which are absolutely not sane whatsoever. They only want to live in a one-season world, you know. And this is, again, extremely unnatural. One can understand it, of course, because, again, the stressed-out person and the person who's been traumatized, well, they're going to be in that passive mode, just want to sit down in front of the TV, you know, or whatever, and be served in a way. So, you know, I understand it. But, you know, as they said, if you don't like knowledge, try ignorance. And unfortunately, you know, we're at this junction point now where the forces that are at work are definitely wanting to continue the enslavement process and make it even deeper. However, as Aldous Huxley and others have said, they don't mind making it a dictatorship without tears. They don't mind making it making us into smiling depressives. They don't mind giving us chains of gold to replace chains of iron. But you see, as I've always said, any kind of imprisonment, I'm not into it. I don't care what kind of imprisonment it is. All imprisonment is bad, regardless of even if it's one with lots of cushions and lots of, you know, that they bring the bowl of soup in on a silver tray. It really doesn't matter. And so what we're seeing now, the global village, you ask what is globalism? What is global village? Global village is really a chains of gold. It's really a servitude with a smile. That you're quite right when you said that they don't really change much. They don't. They're just going to give us a few more cushions and a lot more pacifiers, moving right up to the point where they may even, you know, try to start plugging us into virtual realities. This is where the dark side of the technology is heading, you know, in which we may be spending much more time in cyberspace. They may introduce, you know, the chip into our brain. In exactly the same way you take a drug, we may be moving into that area, you know, very soon, in which we start spending our time in alternative realities, in what we call simulacras, and that word means exactly what it sounds like, a simulation. We're not even in reality today, most people. A simulacra is just a simulated reality, and believe me, these people are quite capable of doing that. You know, all the way back to the first video games and moving up and up and up. Man is already living in a fantasy. He's quite capable of living in a fantasy, you know, in the future.
You said something that kind of struck me, and I can't remember which video I was watching, but it had something to do about the end of humans at 2012. Did I catch that correct? I mean, it's almost...
Yeah, absolutely. That's my work on post-human.
Uh-huh.
Situation and the transhumanism, or whatever they're calling it, some people are calling it, is exactly what we've just been talking about. Is that, you see, the man who is literally, because Freud and Jung also, the psychologists have also talked, I guess it would be more correct to say Wilhelm Reich. The Reichian school has an interesting slant on Freudianism and on psychology. They focus on the body and the biotics. And they talk about armoring. Of course, we already talked about the skyscrapers and this whole armoring way that things are made, and even the sports and the sort of the different exercise, you know, machines and programs. There's a lot of this concept, even in car design, and all across the world, there's a lot of armoring motifs going on. Even the whole bodybuilding cult. I mean, there's so many versions of this, but on a psychological level. Reich was the first one to say the body matters. His critiques of Freud, you see, was that the patient just lies down on a couch, and it's in a sort of a darkened environment almost, and that the whole focus was on the mental, meaning the brain and the communication, the words, and the body was inert. Wilhelm Reich came along. He was a contemporary of Freud, and he said, look, the body here is very static, but the body is an extension of a man's psychology. And I'm a huge, you know, fan of Wilhelm Reich, and partly it's because of this, that he started to incorporate the body physical in the act of psychological healing. Because the body's tensions, I mean, this is obvious to anyone who's done massage or polarity therapy, there's a whole culture of this now, but people often forget who the progenitors of this were. So Wilhelm Reich was the one who started to look into the way a person's body is, you see,
mm-hmm.
is an extension of their thinking. It's tremendously important. And coming out of that Reichian idea is also that the body is where technology begins. Because just as the mind controls the body functions, both consciously and unconsciously, I mean, when you go to sleep, your heart doesn't stop, does it? And the eyes still blink. and the lungs still work, you see. So there's a control, the autonomic control is very much the basis and beginning of man's interest in technology. Let's go back to Sigmund Freud. Freud discovered that he not only had three divisions of consciousness, he had three stages of human development, right? The famous oral, anal, and genital stages, right? And at one of these stages, the human child starts to have control over its own sphincters, right? It must control its own bodily movements, mm-hmm. going to the toilet, eyes watering, mouth dribbling, as children do, right? So control, necessary control over the biology, over the autonomic functions, kicks in. This is very, very necessary as we grow. First we don't have it, then we learn it. This particular biological capacity to control sphincters is very prominent in the male child. And this is what Freud always saw as the male child becoming very interested in gadgets, because it becomes an extension. You see, knobs, levers, switches, and all the rest of it, putting together engines, you know, like the Meccano sets and Lego and all of this stuff. Why are children, human children, interested in this? People don't ever think about this, but psychologists have, and they know that this fascinating interest with puzzles, even with playing things like chess, that's why you have chess prodigies, people who excel in science, the sort of Stephen Hawking type, and of course he would be a perfect example, because what happened to him, he was a quadriplegic. So there's a perfect example there of a man who lost all his bodily control and therefore sublimated it into mental control, mental brilliance with mathematics and with computation and all of these kinds of things. So the very scientific urges, especially technically, arises out of, again, a psychological dynamic in which the human being is necessarily controls their walking, their muscle control, their sphincter control, right? Okay, we've talked about normal development. What do you think kind of technology a male or a female child will be interested in if their thinking is warped for one reason or another, or their parents were warped, or something went off, or, like I said, they're disconnected from their unconscious? Then you're going to have all the gadget fixation, and you're going to have all the interest in technology, but it's going to be in a pathological way. And that is exactly what we find in those people who excel at creating bombs and guns and all the weapons of war, and knives and swords, and who have this fascination, you see, with death and all the rest of it. This is the psychologist who really looked at this was a man called Eric Fromm. He was a sociologist, contemporary of Freud again. Tremendous man, tremendous thinker, who went into this whole thing about the anatomy of human destructiveness and connecting it to these necrotic elements of the human psyche. I dealt with that in other work. And so this is, again, you know, what we find in the world today. So Wilhelm Reich is a tremendously important a scholar who helps us to understand that technology in the body is connected, that the heart moving, the legs walking, you know, all of the different aspects of our human body is really a form of technology in its purest sense. And therefore, man, having control over his body, then wants control over his environment. And as I said about the martial artist, you're going to have two kinds of person. You're going to have a person who just simply wants control over their environment for good reasons. Not because they're particularly acquisitive or dominant or aggressive. But then you're going to have the other kind of person who wants control over his environment because he has no control within. He's incredibly fragile, actually, psychically and spiritually and emotionally and morally. So this becomes your typical tyrannical little bully boy, you know, repulsive, psychopathic creature who goes around, to control everyone, to control the kids, his friends that he grows up with, to control his siblings, to control his parents, driving them absolutely mad, going around beating other people up, you see. He grows into the teenager that becomes the sort of, you know, the gang leader or some sort of other maniac. And then he grows up into the husband who, you know, beats his wife around and causes all sorts of havoc to everybody, who goes thumping and punching and fighting and all sorts of things, who may even go into becoming, you know, wanting to go to the, you know, join the military or join the police force, so he can push, you know, people around and all of these kinds of things. So these people are loose in our society. They're absolutely loose in our society. And again, it's rooted in their connections with their own body. There's a huge element there in their connection with their love-hate relationship with themselves.
So you
it's a whole piece that we've explored about the, you know, man's self-hate and his own self-sadism. An incredible question there about the dichotomy between self-love and self-hate, you know, and narcissism versus egoism and all of these incredible subjects.
So how much do you put environment or diet in on this situation with, you know, ourselves? Does that affect us that much? Or, I mean, you hear the one group that wants to use medications or whatever, or, you know, group settings, whatever. How do you integrate that? Or are you following me? Are you there?
Depends. First of all, I don't. Food is as much as important as people make out.
Okay.
Because you already have to, like, let's take an alcoholic. They have to have a mental type of predisposition to want to go towards these type of pacifiers and drugs in order to take them in the first place.
Uh-huh.
Right? And then, of course, none of those things will adversely affect your... There's drink alcohol and go on and paint beautiful pictures, paintings, you know. There's detectives who need a trigger to free up their mind. You know, the old famous story of Sherlock Holmes and cocaine habit. So, again, you know, it all depends on the person. And remember, I believe also you have to have a predisposition that would attract you to eating some of the wrong substances. It's a feedback loop. The more you eat them, perhaps the more you become addicted. And but I tend to be a person who thinks that you're... What would attract you to doing those things in the place? You already must have some glitch. That attracts you eating the wrong thing, just like it would attract you to hang with the wrong people. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not some very sensitive people who really, really do have to watch what they eat, because it will change your brain and it will change your mood and all those things. But again, those could be bad. A person like that may be a bad habit because mommy or daddy just fed on blinking Cheerios and Twinkies bars from the moment that they were born. Maybe they can't break that habit because that was what they... And it takes them along with the habit. I believe bulimia and even anorexia, these things are all kind of the psychic subliminal influence coming through the television. And I believe that experiments continue to being done. They're not being done, but there has been some also proven this. That it's the images of the women of a female on the television that are so wrong that then force women, you see, into these negative habits. Because remember, they're not thinking they're doing anything bad. They're thinking they're conforming to a false image that's out.
Uh-huh.
In the same way that male children will conform to these other preposterous, you know, images that they give on the television, the male physique and all of that kind of thing.
Okay. So, boy, I don't know where to go with that one, but while we're at it, because I had a couple of friends who had seen that you had the you delve in the tarot, and what do you do with the tarot? What is it that your fascination is with tarot? Are you there?
That's okay. My earliest studies. I have an online mystery school, and, you know, I believe that the divination arts are part. Remember we were talking the kind of cultures existed before?
Uh-huh.
The sorcery?
Right.
Of modern times in the world. I believe that the divination arts are a remnant of those particular ages and that particular holarchic thinking of the shamanic class. That's what I believe. I believe that we have a Western tradition that is very, very ancient, and that if we work with these arts, we not only create an umbilical link back to the original teach of light, you know, what they taught, but we also reconnect ourselves with this holarchic understanding, and we all sanitize the mind. So working with the divination arts brings us back this kind of psychic immunity, this kind of psychic hygiene that we've been talking about, and I also believe that taught aright in the right way. My school, my work with the tarot is more than what people think. It's because I don't believe that the divination arts are being used correctly in the world.
Okay.
I don't believe that ology or tarot, you know, has particularly been used either in a reverent way or in an accurate way, and therefore my work is pretty much trying to bring back certain aspects, connect these arts so that they'll be used correctly. This is also very, very important.
Okay, so, you know, you should give your website, and, you know, is it michaeltessarian.com? Is that correct?
Yeah, and people, that's a navigation page so people can get to all the other websites, or they can just directly to Architects of Control to check out the new DVD we brought out. They can go to OriginsOfCivilization.com to check out the DVD book on that. But just for convenience, they can go to michaeltessarian.com.
Okay.
And if they want to see that thing about Obama, it's going to go to my forum. It's the MSAR forum. There's a link on the Montessorian website. Click on the forum.
Okay.
Go to the On You page. There's a page there called War on You. Click on at the top of the page. We have that thing about the, you know, the lineage of Obama.
Okay. So you're going to get in, how many more editions did you say you're going to do with this Architects of Control 2? Did you say that? Or?
Yeah, probably two more. I think we've got two more that look like they can be planned in, you know, so make it like a...
You there again? Did I lose you?
A three-set.
Okay.
Yeah, like a three-set.
Let me see here. I'm looking at your astrotheology. What is that delving into? We talked about that a little bit.
Okay, that was a book that I... go ahead.
Now, we talked about that a little bit on our last interview, but you might go ahead and reiterate a little bit on what that one was about.
Well, when did we last interview? Do you remember?
It was back in maybe September, October. Seems like it was September.
Okay, so the book came out in July, I think, July or August of last. So it's not that old.
Uh-huh.
But it was began back in 1980 when I first started reading up about astrotheology. It became a lot more interesting when I came across the work of Jordan Maxwell, who to fill in a lot of blanks at the subject. It took me a long time because growing up in Ireland, there was very little information in the way of books. There was no internet then, and there were no books on the subject that you could get your hands. I mean, you would have had to be pretty wealthy and a dole and in no position at all. I pretty much entirely lived on pot noodles. I mean, that tells you how bad things were. So it wasn't a situation of going out and buying, expensive first edition books or anything like that, because you would have had to do it through antiquarian booksellers, and that was just out of the question. Those guys wouldn't even let somebody let me through the door, let alone take orders. So it was very, very difficult, and it was only I really came back to America in the 90s that, again, I had to pick up the study of it and try to locate these books that I, had the names of, works of Gerald Massey and works of Alvin Boyd Kuhn and... Valentina Straton and so many incredible people. The astrotheology book is dedicated to Reverend Robert Lurie, you see, the great astrotheologist, and therefore we're talking 2007, but, again, I've been studying this subject since the 90s, and even though I think the time came for me to start collecting my notes and helping along to these great scholars, It was very, very important. And I had done a DVD on astrotheology. It's very successful. People really, really connected a lot of dots for them. It was a three discs, actually.
Oh, okay.
It's at least six long. Yeah. It was a DVD. It was like 6 days, first set, and it had just feedback.
Mm-hmm.
It just felt like, due to a companion book to that, as I had done the Atlantis, in DVD. And now, of course, I've got the Irish Origins book in DVD. So some of the stuff I did required a companion book, and that was one of them. It really was time to do a book on that. It's actually one of the first books ever. It's not the only one, but one of the first ones that even has astrotheology in the title, which just shows you how slowly this subject has progressed, down through the ages. So the time is definitely right for somebody to do a really good work on astrotheology. And I had a lot of fun doing the book. It felt so good to be able to finally, you know, work on it and get all this information, this knowledge out that had been in my head since I was like 14, 15 years old.
Now, your origin or Origins and Oracles, now that one's like a 6 or 7 DVD set, isn't it? Michael, did I lose you?
That contains the Atlantis DVD and the Astrology DVD.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So you
can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Hello?
Hello? Boy, is it acting up? Doesn't look like it's dropped you, though.
I can hear you.
Okay. So your Origins and Oracles is a combination of several of your DVD sets, then. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. That is a compendium. It's a 22 DVDs, 6 different programs.
Mm-hmm.
Ranging from Atlantis, Phoenician, to the Hermetic tradition, verse of, to 2012, all ideas on 2012. That was a magnum opus that we did, took about 2 years to make. And it was, again, it was there because I felt that I'm very inspired by Joseph Campbell. You know who Joseph Campbell is, right?
Right.
Joseph Campbell had done these marvelous talks. Their time, Mythos, and he did a series of interviews with Bill Moyers, you know.
Uh-huh.
And back in Ireland, that was one of the best shows, you know, that was on. Every time one of these Joseph Campbell things would come on, you know, you'd watch it, and it was so inspiring because the rest of the television was utter garbage, you know, and we weren't really inspired by anything. But it was just like a treat to, you know, have these Joseph Campbell things be shown. I think it was by the BBC, you know, and we just became huge fans of Joseph Campbell. I finally, you know, got a lot of this and got into his work in a big way. And just the idea of being able to stand up, you know, and give this sort of presentation, which went into so many different areas of literature, philosophy, and the whole mythology, you see, was always something that I always thought to myself, you know, one day, if I could ever, you know, put my own, I would use that, you know. So basically, the Origins and Oracles is that kind of presentation. It's that kind of thing. Delve into every little, you know, arcane and occult matter that you can think of, and really go to town. And instead of in it for like 15 minutes, like most TVs are, you know, or 30 minutes, or even, which is so brief. And of course, a lot of those things have commercials. My idea was, you know, listen, if I produce this myself, and I can do it myself, and I can even present it myself, then we have time is not a limit. You know, I could make these 3, 5, 6 discs, you know, and I don't care if people are going to like it, or, you know, if they, if buy it or anything like that. I just feel that this needs to be done this particular way, so that we're not under any constraints of time or budget, you know, or other telling you what you can and cannot do. So completing the Origins and Oracles series was to me a tremendous milestone, you know, because it was something that really needed to be done. Because these subjects, you see, Melody, are, that means they're sick. They cannot be reduced to sound bites like it's continually done in the media, even by well-meaning people. They're constrained by time. They're constrained by money. They're constrained by, you know, the whole process of making a videotape. I mean, how many videotapes can you make? They're bulky. They're heavy. They cost a lot of money to send to people. You know, they wear out really easily, you see. So, again, we're in the world now of this new electronic medium in which DVDs, they never wear out. They're extremely light, you know, they're as light as a feather, and you can do multiple you know, box sets. And so this is the perfect, so, you know, I probably couldn't have done this kind of work back in the 80s media that they had, you know, and you really can't do it on a television type of you know, situation. It's too long. DVDs work absolutely perfectly for that, you know, and people of it, and it's work for them, you know, and we can visit these subjects in great depth, much deeper than you'd ever find on any other type of program in the world, you know, and the only thing comparable to what I've created there is something like Joseph Campbell's, you know, Transformations Over Time. That was my model, that was my mentor, in a sense, and I believe I achieved it. You know, stop right there as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, they're such a great creation.
You know, you do phenomenal amount of work, and I'm sure you've got a great following, and you know, and I've been really caught up in listening to your, I guess you'd more or less call them lectures, as much of anything that's on these DVDs. You do a presentation with them, and you just get so in depth. And so I really highly recommend your work to anybody that is interested in the history, ancient history, and the subjects of, like, origins of evil. I would have never even thought much about, you know, how evil originated, but I found that to be real interesting in its own right.
And just for people who are interested in that thesis, that is the Atlantis DVD book that goes into origins of evil. I cover it a bit in the 2012 DVD, because each of these DVDs in the box set of the Origins and Oracles can be purchased separately. You know, people are not obligated to buy the entire six series. With what I'm doing, each particular DVD is a different subject. Crossover, of course, between them all, because we're talking about their part of attic work. So, in the Origins of Evil, the Atlantis book, you know, and there's also free writings, there's free appendices. In all my books, I don't put the appendices in the books. This is because the book's already quite large, and, you know, they'd be double in size if I put the appendices in them. So all the appendices, the Atlantis book, the Origins and Astrotheology book, are free online. So people go to those individual websites, they go to michaeltassaro.com, and then visit the Atlantis page, or they go to the Irish Origins site, or they go to the Astrotheology site. You know, there's a lot of material there that's free. Should have been in the book, but I've chosen to put there free, and those are worth people to go to. They say they, you know, want to read up more on this before they buy a book.
Well, Michael, I think I'm...
Something like that, what I recommend they go to those websites.
Again, your website again is michaeltassarian.com.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really want to thank you for hanging in there again with my... I keep learning a little bit more each time on working with Skype, particularly with... well, there's always something new and different with Skype, I've found, but when it's working great, it's really great. And there isn't anything more economical for, particularly when you're having to do conversations overseas. And is there anything else you'd like to finish up?
Well, you're coming through.
What?
You're coming through loud and clear. You're coming through loud and clear on my end. You can hear me pretty clearly, yeah?
You know, you've been cutting out some. And I guess I don't know. I'm going to have to do some little more work in learning about some of these aspects of conference calling and that sort. But, hey, I'm... I've come a long ways from when the first time you hung in there before we could ever even get our first program going. So,
right.
So is there anything you wanted to finish up saying before we call it an evening here?
You know, say thanks again, and it's always a pleasure to be on, and, you know, get to share what we've been recently doing, and just you know, should definitely realize that we've got a DVD out there, which is really, you know, up to date and cutting edge with a lot of key stuff that people need to know, and feel free to go and check out. And again, emphasize that, you know, we've got the forum, so people are welcome to come on the forum and leave their comments, because again, this is a collaborative effort. You know, my work is much based on a lot of stuff what people send me as well, and we've created a forum now where people, you know, who do some stuff, we link it up, and people are free to come on and you know, leave comments. They're also free to come on there and post anything that they've discovered in their area. You see, this collaborative action is very, very important, and, you know, we want people to come onto the forum and to leave their comment, check out the most recent links there. We've got some very, very pages there, links that people can check out. As I say, on the various websites I've got, they come. They're free to come on and make use of appendices pages and the free excerpts pages. Also, we'll say that the articles that I've got that are on 2012, if they go to the Michael Tesorian website, click on Next, they'll go to the second page of the website and they'll see the articles there. And those are, there's lists on there, you know, everything that I talk about is sourced. So look and go reference the sources and look at the web streams and the videos and all the stuff that we've got. You know, again, you know, having the websites are important, really follow up on this stuff because it is a deep and meaningful subject. There's no shortcuts. It does take a bit of time, you know, but the empowerment and that comes out of it is overwhelming. We have to take responsibility that it's the way that we are thinking and the way that we're dealing with our own self, these tyranny. And so if people really get into real change, they can realize that voting for various politicians isn't going to help at all. That the only thing to help is, you know, spiritual development, intellectual development, and the no way around that at all. So, you know, our work is very, very much geared for that. And we've made a lot of different materials available. And I want to always emphasize to people that, you know, we're in a day and age now where we are luckier than our forefathers were because of this incredible wealth of information. And we should never feel pessimistic about what's going on. Always see it as a challenge. Realize that we're under divine protection, or that at least each one of us can put ourselves under that divine, and never move out of fear or panic or anxiety, because that's exactly what Big Brother wants.
That's
their
abhan,
their particular kind of sorcery cannot work if the person shakes off the fear and the anxiety and starts to realize.
Well, Michael, again,
that the person who is, it cannot be controlled.
Michael, I hope you will come on again, and I enjoyed having you as a guest, and thank you for getting up so early.
Thanks, Melody. It's lovely to be on. Yeah, and we'll stay in contact. All the best with your show.
Oh, okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks, love.
Okay, bye. That's this little...